Okay, it is September 19th, 2023, Tuesday morning, Pacific time, other times of day in other time zones. So, I was speaking before we started the recording about doing a loving kindness practice using the phrases from the sutta, but particularly what's key about the way I do this that I'm just wanted to share. Is that I recite the lines, radiating kindness over the entire world. And when I refer to the world initially, I am referring to my body. That when I radiate kindness over the entire world, that world is just my body. Because in some sense, that is our world. Okay. Now we can then, of course, then we can spread that. But this is a very effective. I think this is a really important element of loving kindness to get it into your body. And it connects, it's a concentration practice. So that physical element is part of the samadhi experience. So I recite these words, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies, which is upwards to my head, and downwards to the depths, and that's down to my feet. And I'm just feeling into my body, and I'm feeling this loving kindness, radiating kindness. Outward and unbounded then is across the chest and out to the ends of my hands. I don't move my hands out, but I actually sort of imagine that the energy is going across then, so that there's this complete, the body is completely filled then with loving kindness, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. So I repeat that a few times until I start to get infused, shall we say. And then I start to use my imagination to see the loving kindness radiating out throughout the house, throughout where I'm living, throughout the neighborhood, throughout the city, and then up higher, then finally the planet, and then out to the edges of the universe, which maybe doesn't have any edges, so it's unbounded. So I just wanted to share that. Maybe at some point we'll put put those phrases into the chat for people who don't have it memorized, but they are famously in my song, the Metta Nova song, which is on my Laughing Buddha album, and many people, including Abigail, have know those lyrics, know the words because of the song. That's what I use for the chorus. So it's a nice way to learn it is to listen to the song, which is on Spotify. So anyway, this is not marketing. I'm just trying to provide services here, because you know how much money I make every time you listen to my song on Spotify. All right, folks. So good morning. Sorry to go on so long, but let's start with the some sitting, and I will end the sitting by repeating these phrases for you several times, but that will be in 20 minutes. So just settling into your meditation posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Bringing the body into stillness. Into alignment and balance. And having a sense of the energy in the body of the settling. Grounding. the breath moving in the body. Calming. And just acknowledging as you begin to sit, whatever feelings are present for you right now. What your mood is, how alert you are. I often find as I begin a sitting that there's this often just mild agitation and inner restlessness or anxiety, not really focused on anything, but just there's this feeling of movement and makes it more difficult to be still at first. So I have to breathe with that, accept that, sit through that, trusting that through the practice, this restlessness will naturally settle down. I don't try to force it away or push it away. Acceptance is a key aspect of our practice. Not fighting with our experience. Just being with it as it is. And just as there can be energy in the body, there's energy in the mind that keeps generating thoughts. And so we gently bring the attention back to the breath over and over. Again, not fighting with or struggling with thoughts. Accepting that they're just a natural part of being a human. And just returning to the breath when we find we're drifting. We can focus on the breath in a very close way, trying to feel the precise sensations at the nostrils or the belly. Each in-breath and each out-breath. If that's not helpful, you can also just feel the breath in a more open way, just feeling the rhythm of the breath. Having the attention a bit more spacious, allowing in sounds and sensations, while awareness of the breath is continuous, breathing in, breathing out. So we try to learn to work with the different perspectives, orientations in our attention, from the very close to the open and spacious, and then in any moment or period of practice, we try to intuit the most helpful orientation for that period or that moment. Not to be switching around and trying to find some perfect orientation, but just to become familiar with these different perspectives so that we can draw on them whenever it seems most helpful. radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies, downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. All right. Thank you. I will say, if you are like new to meditation, I know that some people drop in here and so my meditation instruction, because I've been doing this class for so long, I don't necessarily give the most progressive or constructive, I don't know, constructive, but I mean, you should listen to other guided meditations. If you're learning meditation, don't just listen to me. I'm kind of more for the people that are in the flow with me over these past couple of years, so that it sort of the guidance, just sort of is a little bit, tends to be more abstract, I'd say. So I have been, the last couple of classes, been reading from Ajahn Amaro's book, Catastrophe Apostrophe, which is a book about dependent origination, one of the deeper and subtler, more complex Buddhist teachings. But the book contains a lot of actually very standard teaching, I guess I'd say, and things that I think are very helpful. So I'm going to read from start from a place, a section called Awareness of Every Realm. Is what I was reading from the part about the six different realms of existence according to Buddhist teachings: the human realm, and the animal realm, and the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realm, and then the jealous god realm, and the heaven realm. So if you're if you have the book Catastrophe Apostrophe, this is seems to be page 54. That's what it says on I've got my Kindle, but it's in the section is Awareness of Every Realm. In the visual depiction of the six realms, in that mirror held by Mahakala, if one looks closely, there is a Buddha to be found in every one of the realms. There is a Buddha present even in the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, that of the asuras, the jealous gods, and the hells. This feature of the iconography symbolizes the fact that in each and every mind state, whether it be heavenly, blissful and wholesome, or unwholesome and painful, such as anger, fear, or compulsion, the quality of wisdom or awareness is available. The Buddha is able to visit that realm. There is no realm that the Buddha can't visit. So the Buddha just represents our mindfulness, our capacity to be aware. He talked about that in the earlier section. For example, if the mind is lost in a train of thought, say a feeling of righteous indignation about something, at a certain moment, there is the recognition that the mind has got lost and has been carried away. That recognition is symbolically represented by a Buddha being present in that realm. In this instance, it would be the Asura realm. It characterizes the quality of wisdom arising, awareness being brought to bear to apprehend and fully know that mind state. We consciously take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha to strengthen the quality of awareness, to make knowing more accessible, to invite the Buddha more effectively into every one of the six realms. That's a critical idea, right? We consciously take refuge when we, and that was the section I read last time. In the Buddha, our capacity to be aware, in the Dharma, in seeing the truth, and in the Sangha, which is the wholesome qualities that arise. To strengthen that quality of awareness, to invite the Buddha more effectively into every one of the six realms, so that when we get caught in some destructive or an unwholesome state, we're more likely to snap out of it, right? Because we've been practicing, because we've been setting this intention to be present. In taking refuge, awareness and wisdom can be brought more easily to meet and receive those distractions or emotions or compulsions, be they unwholesome, wholesome, painful, pleasant, or neutral. In this light, it is significant that in the classical imagery, the Buddha in each realm holds an instrument or object that is particularly relevant for the beings in each realm. He is using the medium that each category of beings can relate to. In the human realm, he holds the alms bowl of a monk. In the Deva realm, he holds a musical instrument, a vinya. In the Asura realm, he holds a flaming sword. In the animal realm, he holds a book. In the hell realm, he holds a flame. In the hungry ghost realm, he holds a bottle of nectar. These different media represent the skillful means through which wisdom needs to operate in order to have an effective impact in each realm upon each psychological state. I was going to go on from there. The next section is about loving kindness, but I kind of do want to go back and look at this a little bit, these different instruments that the Buddha is holding, or object, as you said. In the human realm, the Buddha holds an alms bowl. So we're talking about, there's this famous image that I'm sure many of you have seen, which is that shows the dependent origination and the realms of existence. It's the circle that's got like different people around the edges, and then there's 12 beings around the edges that represent the 12 steps of dependent origination, and inside that there's the six realms of existence, and then inside that you have the three greed, hatred, and delusion. Angela's gonna pull that up. There we go. Beautiful. So what Ajahn Amaro is saying is that in each of these the six inner circles, the Buddha, there's a Buddha, you can see him. The Buddha is in each of those circles. He's inside an oval. You can't really see them here, but he tells us what he's holding. So in the human realm, he holds the alms bowl of a monk. So he had told us earlier that represents the human realm is somebody who lives by the precepts. So a monk is kind of considered the highest form of human, I guess we would say. And then in the Deva realm, he holds a musical instrument. So the Deva realm is like a heaven realm. So, right, you're hearing this beautiful music there. In the Asura realm, he holds a flaming sword. The Asura realm is the jealous gods. These are beings that have a lot of power, but they're fighting with each other a lot. So they're the typical, you know, real life comparison is politicians. Like they have a lot of power and they might have wealth and, you know, influence, but they're fighting all the time. They're not really happy, right? In the animal realm, he holds a book. So the animal realm, right? The animals, their problem is that they don't understand stuff. They're not intelligent enough. So presumably that's why the Buddha brings a book. In the hell realm, he holds a flame. Now, I find that a little bit confusing because the hell realm is already fiery, so I'm not sure why he brings a flame. I wish he would bring like a fire hose to the hell realm, but anyway, that's what it says. In the hungry ghost realm, he holds a bottle of nectar. So the hungry ghost realm is the realm of addiction that, you know, Gabor Mate famously has a book in the realm of the hungry ghost. And so the nectar obviously is meant to feed the people, the hungry ghosts who are, can never be satisfied and are need to, you know, are always seeking more. They have tiny throats and huge bellies. So they're always unsatisfied. So he's bringing them nectar to feed them. And that's kind of an interesting. So obviously none of this is meant to be literal as much as pointing for ourselves to these different realms that, and that I mentioned before that Mark Epstein's book, Thoughts Without a Thinker, goes through these realms and is even more explicit in talking about their psychological meaning or the sort of psychological states that they represent. And this is where, and this is what obviously Ajahn Amaro is getting at when he says that the Buddha can visit these different realms, that we can wake up. So in the Deva realm, we can be, you know, really blissed out, but that doesn't mean we're wise, right? So, and this is very tricky, you know, and particularly with meditation, we can get into a very blissed out state, but that doesn't mean we're gaining insight. So we need to make sure that the insight or the mindfulness is there, even in these states of bliss and joy. The Asura realm is just as I described, like the politician who's fighting for power. But, you know, we all get into these power struggles in our lives, right? Where we are, you know, trying to deal, you know, in business and in family relationships, these kind of struggles we get into. And again, to bring in insight and wisdom as we're doing that, rather than just letting ourselves be overcome with rage, you know, we can remember to be compassionate in a particular moment, be accepting, be caring of people. The animal realm, you know, is the one where we all, each of us, we can get caught in just craving, you know, be it, you know, for food or sexual pleasure or just any kind of sense pleasure. And again, to bring mindfulness to that. So, okay, I can be here with this craving. I don't have to be driven by the compulsion. And that, you know, the hungry ghost realm then kind of, to me, takes that animal realm one step further, where it becomes almost overwhelming. And here we really, that nectar to me really represents care and taking care of ourselves. And how can I take care of this terrible hunger within me, this suffering that comes out of my own craving? The hell realm, really, really difficult to wake up in the hell realm. You thought that was wine he was bringing to the addicts. So, okay, well, could be. But the hell realm, you know, is when we're just caught up in rage or fear, you know, panic. And here, you know, my sense of that is that mostly what we have to do in those situations is to find a way to step out of the triggering situation. So if we're in a, you know, a rage with another person, to just walk away, right? If there is a panic happening, to get out of the situation that's causing it. I think about when I was getting a treatment last year for when I was going to have surgery that day, and they were I can't even, there was like this preparation for it that involved being in something similar to a to an MRI. It wasn't so enclosed, but I started to have a anxiety attack in that setting, and I called out to the person who was running the treatment and said, I have to get out. I have to stop. And it was just that, like, because I couldn't, for me, the hell realms are too powerful to actually be present with the hell experience. And I'm sure that there are those who have more mental power than I, but that's my solution to it. So this is, I think, a great kind of way to think about our experiences and to know that, you know, that the solution to every situation is the same. So it's not like we have to, oh, there's these six realms and I've got to get all these different things. No. I just have to try to be awake and conscious in whatever the realm is. And I think it does help to, first of all, understand this model, because it can help us to be more objective about what's happening, to kind of step out of it and say, oh, like, I'm in an animal realm right now, or I'm in a jealous God realm right now. I can, and so that I don't take it quite so personally. And it, you know, the particulars of the situation don't overwhelm my mindfulness, because very often that's what happens to us, that the particular elements of something, some situation, become so compelling in themselves that we lose sight of the generic thing that's happening, so that we can go, oh, I'm just really angry right now, or I'm, you know, this is just sadness, or wow, this is really blissful, but can I enjoy it? You know, can I be present for it rather than just being swept up in it? Is there something I need to do to take care of myself right now? This is really difficult. So I love this idea of how we can identify mind states and then have this clear solution, which is always to be present, to start with mindfulness, and then view it through that lens of mindfulness and Dharma. And then, you know, then I think, you know, the answers will come if our own house is in order. Our answers, the skillful response to that situation will be much more clear when we have mindfulness rather than when we are caught up in that situation. So it's actually a very short section. And as I said, I was going to, let me read a little bit more, because I see I've got 15 minutes and I wanted to take you into the next section, with just called Loving Kindness, Expressive and Receptive. And I'm not going to read all of this. There's a few parts that I found particularly helpful. So another aspect of the symbolism is that the Buddha is always a loving presence, even if he is carrying a sword or flame. Buddha wisdom is the embodiment of profound loving kindness, that radical acceptance which facilitates the process of liberation and frees beings from the wheel of becoming. Many years ago, when Ajahn Sumedho first began teaching in the UK and Europe, he would use the classical phrases for teaching loving kindness, metta meditation. May I be happy, may I be well, may all beings be happy, may they all be well. Most English people would think, ugh, this is so sentimental, it's really annoying. You're trying to teach loving kindness, but it makes me really irritated. It's too sweet, sentimental, like thinking pink. I remember one person on a retreat saying, I was doing fine. I was very happy until you started teaching metta. Then I got really angry. Ajahn Sumedho was a very creative and adaptable teacher. He thus employed some skillful means and changed the language that he used to describe metta. He defined it instead as, quote, not dwelling in aversion. And so this, for those who have been following me over the recent years, you know, recognize the similarity with my book, Living Kindness, that puts a lot of focus on non-ill will, which is a phrase that's in, a very similar phrase, at least, in the Metta Sutta. Before the Buddha says radiating kindness, he says, he talks about not despise any being, to not have hatred. So he says, if we confuse metta for meaning that we're supposed to like all beings and all mind states, it can be really irritating because there are many things about our own minds and other people that are not likable. Those hell realms of anger and conflict are still hot and painful, but they are the way they are. The Buddha carries a flame to those realms, but he is not averse or impatient. He is as calm and benevolent as he is everywhere. If you have chronic pain or you've had a headache for 3 days, you can't like it, but you can accept it. Here it is. If you have a difficult family member who is causing you a lot of stress, you can't like that, but you can accept it. This is a practical and realistic way of understanding metta. It is a quality of acceptance and open-heartedness, of seeing things, of clearly seeing this is the way things are, rather than trying to feel we have to force ourselves to like everything. Okay. So the end of this section I particularly liked, where he says, on considering all of this, it can be seen that the practice of loving kindness has both a receptive and an expressive aspect. The expressive quality of metta manifests in the conscious radiating of benevolent feelings toward others and to oneself while wishing, spreading kindness, sending goodwill out to every being. It is like the outbreath. The receptive aspect of metta is like the in-breath, taking everything in and opening our hearts to each other and to the way things are. This is the radical acceptance, the not dwelling in aversion, the attunement to the reality of the way things are, that is also the life source of wisdom. Accordingly, just as it is the in-breath that gathers the oxygen that our bodies need to stay alive, and it is the out-breath that expels the unneeded carbon dioxide, so too, I would say, it is the receptive acceptance aspect of metta that is its essence, and the expressive aspect, which is a natural and helpful result of that. Now, this I find to be a really interesting reflection, to think of loving kindness as having a receptive aspect and an expressive aspect. So, you know, we fill ourselves with loving kindness and then we radiate it. And of course, if we don't have it inside, we can't radiate it. And in the way I was offering those phrases today, is this is actually receptive, even though I'm using the phrases radiating, because it's the same thing. That is, loving kindness is the same thing, whether it's receiving it or radiating it, it's the same energy. And I just find that it's helpful to, because meditating within the body is what really grounds us, to work with the language of loving kindness as a felt experience through the body is a great way to build it up. So it's not just an idea, right? Like, may all be, I'm not just like thinking this thing, I'm feeling it through my body. So I'm taking it in this receptive way. And then I'm radiating it out in this expressive way. In any case, so I hope that's helpful. I find this book to be quite rich. And, you know, if you have the book or you looked at it, you know that I've skipped over large portions of the beginning, which go into more into dependent origination. And later in the book, he goes back to it. But these middle parts, he's covering some of the things that I consider sort of like basic Dharma, but in this really helpful and refreshing way. So I hope that that was helpful to people, and I'll open it up now if anybody wants to make a comment or ask a question. Abigail, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question, which is that this definition of Sangha is different from what I've always heard or misinterpreted or assumed. I've often thought of Sangha as being our community.
Right.
But this one is not that.
Well, right. So it's an intriguing take. And again, it's trying to get at an underlying meaning of Sangha that's more symbolic. I don't know if symbolic is the right word. But let me go back to what he says in the earlier section of the book about Sangha. The taking of refuge in the Sangha also has inner and outer aspects. Externally, this is choosing to be guided by and to take it as example those beings who have awakened to the truth, to the Dhamma, and who are the enlightened disciples of the Buddha. So in the original meaning of Sangha in the early Buddhism, the Sangha was referred just to the enlightened followers of the Buddha. Now, over time, then, in our typical Western democratic way, we've said, well, don't leave anybody out. Let's let everybody who's part of the club. You know, everybody's part of the Sangha. So now we refer to Sangha as just our community. But then he goes further with it, right? So he says, the internal aspect of Sangha is about how we practice, how that noble heart manifests in the world. Refuge and Sangha internally can mean a variety of things, but since the description of the Sangha refuge lists the qualities of goodness, respecting and loving the good, loving to act in a straightforward way, loving to act in a well-integrated way, how to be accomplished in goodness, I feel that the most accurate and helpful way of understanding it is to take refuge in the Sangha as, quote, choosing to listen to the voice in the heart that loves the good. This is the inner aspect of the Sangha refuge, the Sangha jewel. Mm-hmm. So the way Ajahn Amaro has expressed this before, and he told me this when I met with him when I was writing One Breath at a Time, and he talked about the Sangha as what arises when the Buddha sees the Dhamma. So the Buddha is the one who knows our own innate wisdom. No, not talking about the historical Buddha. We're talking about our own inner our mindfulness. When we see with mindfulness the truth, which is the Dhamma, what comes out of that is skillful behavior, following the precepts, acting out of kindness. So this is the sort of archetypal way of viewing it, that there's this inner process and that the Sangha is this inner refuge of purity that arises when you are wise, when you see the truth. Now that then when it's shared in a community, then you have a bunch of people who are all expressing this in the same way, right? So Sangha just doesn't just mean a bunch of people that show up at a meditation group. It refers to people that are trying to live in this wholesome way, right? So the people in an AA meeting might not all be sober. So, you know, but the ones that we really consider to be, you know, in recovery, those are the ones who are the Sangha, who are the fellowship. Not that we're eliminating, we're not saying anybody else isn't welcome, but we're saying, you know, if you're not sober, you're not really in recovery. So you're not really in this yet, you know, maybe you're working on it. And maybe that's not the best analogy, but the point is that, but it's this manifestation. So Sangha is what manifests when the Buddha and Dhamma are mental, right? The Buddha is the wisdom mind. The Dhamma is the truth. But then there's this physical manifestation, which is the, anyway.
Thank you.
I said too much.
No, so. You did. It was wonderful. Thank you so much. It makes it much clearer.
Okay. Yeah. So it's got these two different. It just as the same way that Buddha has two meanings. It has a literal meaning of the historic Buddha, and then it has this metaphorical meaning of the awakened mind. Dharma has the literal meaning of the teachings of the Buddha, and then it has this more metaphorical meaning of just the way things are, that as we experience them in the moment through our wisdom. Oh, thank you, Angela, for putting in the information about my upcoming day long. So anybody who's interested, and I am going to, so let me stop and complete my sentences. September 30th, I'm going to teach a day long at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery on the Anapanasati Sutta, which is mindfulness of breathing. And then on October 7th, the following Saturday, I'll be at the Sati Center in Redwood City to teach on living kindness. The Anapanasati one will also be hybrid, and I'm going to set that up. It'll be on my website, the link, and it'll be just like this class. There'll just be a link on there, and well, I'm going to go over there early that morning. I'll just have to get my computer on their Wi-Fi, but I'll just run it off my computer one way or another. The link didn't work for the October 7th day long. Oh, wow.
You know, actually, yesterday, Anne and I were having issues getting onto your website.
Yeah, my website was down yesterday.
Okay.
Okay. So, good question. Thank you, Flo. Keep trying. If there's still problems, because I'm seeing I'm having trouble with it too. Yeah, it looks like I will get in touch with my web person. It could be if you've got my website cached, you might have to like start again or something. I don't, you know, how that all works. But thank you. I'll straighten that out. So don't give up. In the words of Peter Gabriel. Steve.
Yeah, just a quick question, Kevin. On the September 30th in Berkeley, are they going to have accommodations for those of us who can't sit on the floor? Do they have chairs there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They've got great chairs. Very comfortable. Okay. Yep.
And it's fairly good size if I can bring a few people with me.
Absolutely. There's probably room for 100 people there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, please bring them along. And just don't bring onions and garlic.
I'll be aware of that. I remember you said that.
I mean, it's that tradition there. They don't They don't eat onions, garlic. They consider them to be
steamed. I've been in enough public settings that I appreciate that, because it's no fun sitting next to a bunch of people who've been eating garlic.
Well, I suppose there is that too. And yeah and I'm not there won't be any food, so you need to bring your own lunch or else go. There's places in downtown Berkeley. So
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So, Anne, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to say, this coming back into balance when you realize you're in this unwholesome state or a destructive, unhelpful state, it's still, I had this experience yesterday. I got some criticism, which I thought was kind of rude. You know, I was working on a project and I got some feedback, which didn't, it was like weird. And and my immediate, and I had this immediate, like, you know, anger and then sadness and then like, oh, here it comes. And then in a moment, I was like, all of a sudden this like balance sort of came in and I saw it clearly for what it was. And it's just kind of like a magical moment. It still feels like, wow, I didn't go there. You know, I didn't have to go there. It's, I don't know.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah.
So according to Ajahn Amaro, you've taken refuge.
Yeah, the Buddha within came up.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Because that's a tough one for me. Criticism, perceived.
Oh, God.
Perceived or otherwise. It's really, really hard.
I know. Like, when I get sent like evaluations from my teaching, I'm like, yeah, somebody else read that for me. I actually just did read some evaluations last night and there wasn't really too much. thank you. Thank you all for
just coming back into balance is lovely. It's
yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is. It's somewhat miraculous, you know, for sure. So, I'll be back on Friday night. I might have a report from the monastery. So I'm going to the Abhayagiri tomorrow to see Ajahn Pasano. So, but maybe I won't come back, you know, maybe that'll be it. I'll put on the white robes and become an anagarika and start cooking all their meals. Not like
is that the monastery up in Ukiah?
Yes, that's right. Well, it's near Ukiah. The city of 10,000 Buddhas is actually in Ukiah, I think. But Abhayagiri is a redwood valley. Yeah,
I know where it is. Yeah,
yeah. All right, folksies. Nice to see everybody.
Thank you, Kevin.